Now, tell me everything.
Thus encouraged, Alec began to talk. Instead of movie music in the background, he heard the steady clitter, clitter, clitter of her keyboard as she took notes. And before the conversation was finished, he was glad he hadn't hung up. She asked good questions, sharp questions. The oddities of the case didn't seem to faze her in the slightest. It was a goddamn shame that Bill Hodges was dead, but Alec thought he might have found a perfectly adequate replacement. When he was finally done, he asked, "Are you intrigued?"
"Yes, Mr. Pelly."
"Alec. You're Holly, and I'm Alec."
"All right, Alec. Finders keepers will take this case. I will send you regular reports, either by phone, email, or FaceTime, which I find is far superior to Skype. When I have gotten everything I can, I will send you a complete summary."
"Thank you. That sounds very..."
"Yes. Now, let me give you an account number so you can transfer the retainer fee to our bank in the amount we discussed."
Holly, July 22nd through July 24th. 1. She put back the office phone, which she always brought home with her, although Pete kidded her about it, on its stand next to her home phone, and sat quiet in front of her computer for perhaps 30 seconds. Then she pushed the button on her Fitbit to check her pulse. 75. 8 to 10 beats faster than normal. She wasn't surprised. Pelly's story of the Maitland affair had excited and engaged her in a way no case had since finishing with the late and very horrible Brady Hartsfield. Except that wasn't exactly right. The truth was, she hadn't been really excited about anything since Bill had died. Pete Huntley was fine, but he was, here in the silence of her nice apartment, she could admit it, a bit of a plotter. He was happy to chase the deadbeats, bail jumpers, stolen cars, lost pets, and daddies delinquent on child support. And while Holly had told Alec Pelly nothing but the truth, she really did abhor violence, except in movies. It made her tummy hurt. Chasing after Hartsfield had made her feel alive in a way nothing had since. That was also true of Morris Bellamy, a crazy literature buff who had killed his favorite writer. There would be no Brady Hartsfield or Morris Bellamy waiting for her in Dayton, which was good, because Pete was on vacation in Minnesota, and her young friend Jerome was on vacation with his family in Ireland.
"I'll kiss the Blarney Stone for you, darling,"
he had said at the airport, employing an Irish brogue every bit as awful as his Amos and Andy accent, which he still put on occasionally, mostly to offend her.
"You better not," she'd said. "Think of the germs on that thing."
"Oof." Alec Pelly thought I'd be put off by the strangeness, she thought, smiling a little. He thought I'd just say, "This is impossible. People can't be in two places at the same time, and people can't disappear from archived news footage. It's either a practical joke or a hoax." Only what Alec Pelly doesn't know, and I won't tell him, is that people can be in two places at the same time. Brady Hartsfield did it, and when Brady finally died, he was in another man's body.
"Anything is possible," she said to the empty room. "Anything at all. The world is full of strange nooks and crannies."
She booted up Firefox and found the address of the Tommy and Tuppence pub. The closest lodging was the Fairview Hotel on Northwoods Boulevard. Was it the same hotel the Maitland family had stayed in? She would ask Alec Pelly via email, but it seemed likely, bearing in mind what the older Maitland daughter had said. Holly checked Trivago and saw she could get an acceptable room for $92 per night. She considered upgrading to a small suite, but only for a moment. That would be padding the expense account, a shoddy business practice, and a slippery slope. She called the Fairview on the office phone, since this was a legitimate expense, made a reservation for 3 nights starting tomorrow, then opened Math Cruncher on her computer. In her opinion, it was the best program for solving everyday problems. Check-in time at the Fairview was 3 o'clock, and the turnpike speed at which her Prius got optimum gas mileage was 63 miles per hour. She figured in one stop to top up the tank and get a no-doubt substandard meal at a roadside rest, added 45 minutes for the inevitable slowdown due to road work. "I'll leave at 10 o'clock," she said. "No, better make it 9:50, just to be safe." And to be even safer, she used her Waze app to suss out an alternate route should that be necessary. She showered so she wouldn't have to do it in the morning, put on her nightie, brushed her teeth, flossed. The latest study said flossing was not useful in protecting against dental decay, but it was part of Holly's routine, and she would be content to floss until she died. Took out her hair clips and put them in a line, then went into the spare bedroom, padding in her bare feet. The room was her film library. The shelves were lined with DVDs, some in colorful store cases, most homemade courtesy of Holly's state-of-the-art disc burner. There were thousands, 4,375 currently, but the one she wanted was easy to find because the discs were alphabetized. She took it down and placed it on her nightstand, where she would be sure to see it when she packed in the morning. With that taken care of, she got down on her knees, closed her eyes, and folded her hands. Morning and evening prayers had been her analyst's idea, and when Holly protested that she did not exactly believe in God, her analyst said that a vocalizing of her concerns and plans to a hypothetical higher power would help, even if she didn't, and that actually seemed to be the case. "It's Holly Gibney again, and I am still trying to do my best. If you're there, please bless Pete while he's fishing, because only an idiot goes out in a boat when he doesn't know how to swim. Please bless the Robinsons over there in Ireland, and if Jerome really is thinking about kissing the Blarney Stone, I wish you'd make him think better of it. I am drinking Boost to try and put on a little weight, because Dr. Stonefield says I'm too thin. I don't like it, but each can has 240 calories, according to the label. I'm taking my Lexapro, and I'm not smoking. Tomorrow I'm going to Dayton. Please help me to stay safe in my car, obey all traffic rules, and help me to do the best I can with the facts at hand, which are interesting," she considered. "I still miss Bill. I guess that's all for tonight." She got into bed and was asleep 5 minutes later. 2. Holly arrived at the Fairview Hotel at 3:17 p.m., not quite optimum, but not bad. She reckoned it would have been 3:12 had not every fracking traffic light been against her once she left the turnpike. The room was fine. The bath towels on the shower door had been hung a bit crooked, but she set that situation to rights after using the toilet and washing her hands and face. There was no DVD player attached to the television, but at $92 a night, she hadn't expected one. If she felt a need to watch the film she had brought, her laptop would be perfectly adequate. Made on the cheap and shot in probably no more than 10 days, it wasn't the sort of movie that required high resolution and Dolby sound. Tommy and Tuppence was less than a block from the hotel. Holly could see the sign as soon as she stepped from beneath the hotel awning. She walked down and studied the menu posted in the window. In the upper left-hand corner was a pie with steam rising from its crust. Printed below this was, "Steak and kidney pie is our specialty." She strolled down another block and came to a parking lot, which was about three-quarters full. "City parking," said the sign out front. "6-hour limit." She went in, looking for tickets on windshields or traffic warden's chalk marks on tires. She saw neither, which meant that no one was enforcing the six-hour limit. It was strictly honor system. It wouldn't work in New York, but it probably worked just fine in Ohio. With no monitoring, there was no way to tell how long the van had been here after Merlin Cassidy had abandoned it. But she guessed that with the doors unlocked and the keys dangling invitingly from the ignition, it probably hadn't lasted too long. She walked back to Tommy and Tuppence, introduced herself to the hostess, and said she was an investigator working a case that had to do with a man who had stayed nearby last spring. It turned out the hostess was also part owner, and with the evening rush still an hour away, she was perfectly willing to talk. Holly asked if she happened to remember just when the restaurant had leafleted the area with menus.
"What did the guy do?" the hostess asked. Her name was Mary, not Tuppence, and her accent was New Jersey rather than Newcastle.
"I'm not at liberty to say," Holly told her. "It's a legal matter. You understand?"
"Well, I do remember," Mary said. "It'd be funny if I didn't."
"Why is that?"
"When we first opened 2 years ago, this was Fredo's place. You know, like in The Godfather."
"Yes," Holly said. "Although Fredo is best remembered for Godfather II, especially for the sequence where his brother Michael kisses him and says, 'I know it was you, Fredo. You broke my heart.'"
"I don't know about that, but I do know that there are about 200 Italian restaurants in Dayton, and we were getting killed. So we decided to try British food. You can't exactly call it cuisine. Fish and chips, bangers and mash, even beans on toast. And changed the name to Tommy and Tuppence, like in the Agatha Christie books. We figured we had nothing to lose at that point, and you know what? It worked. I was shocked, but in a good way, believe me. We filled this place for lunch, and most nights for dinner."
She leaned forward, and Holly could smell gin on her breath, bright and clear.
"Want to know a secret?"
"I love secrets," Holly said truthfully.
"The steak and kidney pie comes frozen from a company in Paramus. We just heat it up in the oven. And you know what? The restaurant critic from the Dayton Daily News loved it. He gave us 5 stars. I shit you not."
She leaned forward a little more and whispered,
"If you tell anyone that, I'd have to kill you."
Holly zipped a thumb across her thin lips and turned an invisible key, a gesture she'd seen Bill Hodges make on many occasions. "So, when you reopened with the new name and the new menu, or maybe just before?"
"Johnny, he's my hubby, wanted to paper the neighborhood a week before. But I told him that was no good. People would forget, so we did it the day before. We hired a kid and printed enough menus for him to cover a 9-block area."
"Including the parking lot up the street?"
"Yes. Is that important?"
"Would you check your calendar and tell me what day that was?"
"Don't need to. It's engraven on my memory." She tapped her forehead. "April 19th, a Thursday. We opened, reopened, actually, on Friday."
Holly restrained an urge to correct Mary's grammar, thanked her, and turned to go.
"Sure you can't tell me what the guy did?"
"Very sorry, but I'd lose my job."
"Well, at least come in for dinner, if you're staying in town."
"I'll do that," Holly said, but she wouldn't. God knew what else on the menu had been shipped frozen from Paramus. 3. The next step was a visit to the Heisman Memory Unit and a talk with Terry Maitland's father, if he was having a good day, presuming he had good days anymore. Even if he was off in the clouds, she might be able to talk to some of the people who worked there. In the meantime, here she was in her pretty good hotel room. She powered up her laptop and sent Alec Pelley an email titled, "Gibney Report No. 1. Tommy and Tuppence menus were leafleted in a 9-block area on Thursday, April 19th, based on interview with co-owner Mary Hollister, I am confident the date is correct. Such being the case, we can be sure it was the date Merlin Cassidy abandoned the van in nearby parking lot. Note that Maitland family arrived Dayton around noon on Saturday, April 21st. I am almost positive the van was gone by then. I will check with local police tomorrow, hoping to close off one more possibility, and will then visit the Heisman Memory Unit. If questions, email or call my cell. Holly Gibney, Finders Keepers. With that taken care of, Holly went down to the hotel restaurant and ordered a light meal. She never even considered room service, which was always ridiculously expensive. She found a Mel Gibson film she hadn't seen on the in-room movie menu and ordered it $9.99, which she would deduct from her report of expenses when she filed it. The picture wasn't great, but Gibson did the best he could with what he had. She noted the title and the running time in her current movie logbook. Holly had already filled over 24 others, giving it 3 stars. With that taken care of, she made sure both of the room's door locks were engaged, said her prayers, finishing, as she always did, by telling God that she missed Bill, and went to bed, where she slept for 8 hours with no dreams, at least none that she remembered. 4. The next morning, after coffee, a brisk 3-mile walk, breakfast at a nearby cafe, and a hot shower, Holly called the Dayton Police Department and asked for traffic division. Following a refreshingly brief interval on hold, an officer Linden came on the line and asked how he could help her. Holly found this delightful. A polite policeman always brightened her day, although, to be fair, most of them were in the Midwest. She identified herself, said she was interested in a white Econoline van that had been left in a public parking lot on Northwoods Boulevard in April, and asked if DPD regularly checked the city's honor lots.
"Sure," Officer Linden said, "but not to enforce the 6-hour limit. They're cops, not meter maids."
"I understand," Holly said, "but they must keep an eye out for possible dump-offs, don't they?"
Linden laughed. "Your company must do a lot of repos and retrievals."
"Along with bail jumpers, they're our bread and butter."
"Then you know how it works. We're especially interested in expensive cars that have been hanging around those lots for a while, both in town and in long-term parking at the airport. Your Denalis, your Escalades, your Jags and Beamers. You say this van you're interested in had New York plates?"
"Correct."
"A van like that probably wouldn't have drawn much attention the first day. People from New York do come to Dayton, strange as it may seem. But if it was still there on the second day, probably."
"Which still would have been a full day before the Maitlands arrived." "Thank you, officer."
"I could check the impound yard if you want."
"That won't be necessary. The van next showed up 1,000 miles south of here."
"What's your interest in it, if you don't mind me asking?"
"Not at all," Holly said. This was a police officer, after all. "It was used to abduct a child who was subsequently murdered." 5. Now 99% sure the van had been gone well before Terry Maitland arrived in Dayton with his wife and daughters on April 21st, Holly drove her Prius to the Heisman Memory Unit. It was a long, low sandstone building in the middle of at least 4 acres of well-kept grounds. A grove of trees separated it from Kindred Hospital, which probably owned it, operated it, and made a tidy profit thereby. It certainly didn't look cheap. Either Peter Maitland had a large nest egg, good insurance, or both, Holly thought approvingly. There were plenty of empty guest spaces at this hour of the morning, but Holly chose one at the far end of the lot. Her Fitbit goal was 12,000 steps a day, and every little bit helped. She paused for a minute to watch 3 orderlies walking 3 residents, one of the latter actually looked as if he might know where he was, then went inside. The lobby was high-ceilinged and pleasant, but beneath the smells of floor wax and furniture polish, Holly could detect a faint odor of pee wafting out from deeper in the building. And something else, something heavier. It would have been foolish and melodramatic to call it the smell of lost hope. But that was what it smelled like to Holly, just the same. Probably because I spent so much of my early life staring at the hole instead of the donut, she thought. The sign on the main desk read, "All visitors must check in." The woman behind the desk, Mrs. Kelly, according to the little plaque on the counter, gave Holly a welcoming smile. "Hello there. How may I help?" To this point, all was ordinary and unremarkable. Things only went off the rails when Holly asked if she could visit Peter Maitland. Mrs. Kelly's smile remained on her lips, but disappeared from her eyes. "Are you a member of the family?" "No," Holly said. "I'm a friend of the family." This, she told herself, was not exactly a lie. She was working for Mrs. Maitland's lawyer, after all, and the lawyer was working for Mrs. Maitland, and that qualified as a kind of friendship, didn't it, if she had been hired to clear the name of the widow's late husband? "I'm afraid that won't do," said Mrs. Kelly. What remained of her smile was now purely perfunctory. "If you're not family, I'm afraid I'll have to ask you to leave. Mr. Maitland wouldn't know you anyway. His condition has deteriorated this summer." "Just this summer, or since Terry came to visit him in the spring?" Now the smile was gone entirely. "Are you a reporter? If you are, you are required by law to tell me, and I will ask you to leave the premises at once. If you refuse, I'll call security and have you escorted. We've had quite enough of your kind." This was interesting. It might not have anything to do with the matter she had come here to investigate, but maybe it did. The woman hadn't gone all poopy, after all, until Holly mentioned Peter Maitland's name. "I'm not a reporter." "I'll take your word for that, but if you're not a relative, I still must ask you to leave." "All right," Holly said. She took a step or two away from the desk, then had an idea and turned back. "Suppose I had Mr. Maitland's son, Terry, call and vouch for me. Would that help?" "I suppose," Mrs. Kelly said. She looked grudging about it. "He would have to answer a few questions, though, to satisfy me that it wasn't one of your colleagues pretending to be Mr. Maitland. That might sound a trifle paranoid to you, Ms. Gibney, but we have been through a lot here. A lot. And I take my responsibilities very seriously."
"I understand."
"Maybe you do and maybe you don't. But it wouldn't do you any good to speak to Peter in any case. The police found that out. He's an end-stage Alzheimer's. If you talk to the younger Mr. Maitland, he'll tell you."
"The younger Mr. Maitland won't tell me anything, Mrs. Kelly, because he's been dead for a week. But you don't know that, do you?"
"When was the last time the police tried to talk to Peter Maitland? I'm asking as a friend of the family." Mrs. Kelly considered this, then said, "I don't believe you, and I'm not answering your questions." Bill would have gotten all chummy and confidential at this point. He and Mrs. Kelly might even have ended by exchanging email addresses and promising to stay in touch on Facebook. But although Holly was an excellent deductive thinker, she was still working on what her analyst called people skills. She left a bit disheartened, but not discouraged. This kept getting more interesting.
6. At 11 o'clock on that bright and sunny Tuesday morning, Holly sat on a shady bench in Andrew Dean Park, sipping a latte from a nearby Starbucks and thinking about her queer interview with Mrs. Kelly. The woman hadn't known Terry was dead. Probably none of the Heisman staff knew, and that didn't surprise Holly very much. The murders of Frank Peterson and Terry Maitland had happened in a small city hundreds of miles away. If it had made the national news at all during a week when an
ISIL sympathizer had shot 8 people in a Tennessee shopping mall, and a tornado had leveled a small Indiana town, it would only have been as a blip far down on Huffington Post, there and gone. And it wasn't as if Marcy Maitland would have been in touch with her father-in-law to tell him the sad news. Why would she, considering the man's condition? "Are you a reporter?" Mrs. Kelly had asked. "We've had quite enough of your kind." All right. Reporters had come to call, also the police, and Mrs. Kelly, as the out-front person at the Heisman Memory Unit, had had to put up with them. But their questions hadn't been about Terry Maitland, or she would have known he was dead. So what had been the great big fracking deal? Holly set her coffee aside, took her iPad from her shoulder bag, powered it up, and verified that she had 5 bars, which would save her from having to go back to the Starbucks. She paid a small fee to access the archives of the local paper, duly noting it for her expense report, and began her search on April 19th, the day Merlin Cassidy had dumped the van. Also the day it had almost certainly been re-stolen. She went through the local news carefully and found nothing relating to the memory unit. That was true for the following 5 days as well, although there was plenty of other news. Car crashes, 2 home invasions, a nightclub fire, an explosion at a gas station, an embezzlement scandal involving a school department official, a manhunt for 2 missing sisters, white, from nearby Trotwood, a police officer accused of shooting an unarmed teenager, black, a synagogue defaced with a swastika. Then, on April 25th, the front page headline screamed that Amber and Jolene Howard, the missing Trotwood girls, had been found dead and mutilated in a ravine not far from their home. An unnamed police source said, "Those little girls were subjected to acts of unbelievable savagery." And yes, both girls had been sexually molested. Terry Maitland had been in Dayton on April 25th. Of course, he had been with his family, but there were no new developments on the 26th of April, the day Terry Maitland had visited his father for the last time, and nothing on the 27th, the day the Maitland family had flown home to Flint City. Then on Saturday, the 28th, the police announced that they were questioning a person of interest. 2 days later, the person of interest was arrested. His name was Heath Holmes. He was 34 years of age, a Dayton resident who was employed as an orderly at the Heisman Memory Unit. Holly picked up her latte, drank half of it in large gulps, then stared off into the shadowy depths of the park with wide eyes. She checked her Fitbit. Her pulse was galloping along at 110 beats a minute, and it wasn't just caffeine pushing it. She went back to the Daily News archives, scrolling through May and into June, following the thread of the story. Unlike Terry Maitland, Heath Holmes had survived his arraignment, but very much like Terry, Jeannie Anderson would have called it a confluence, he would never be tried for the murders of Amber and Jolene Howard. He had committed suicide in Montgomery County Jail on June 7th. She checked her Fitbit again and saw her pulse was now up to 120. She chugged down the rest of her latte anyway, living dangerously. "Bill, I wish you were on this with me. I wish that so much. And Jerome, him too. The 3 of us would have grabbed the reins and ridden this pony until it stopped running." But Bill was dead. Jerome was in Ireland, and she wouldn't get any closer to figuring this out than she already was, at least not on her own. But that didn't mean she was done in Dayton. No, not quite. She went back to her hotel room, ordered a sandwich from room service, damn the expense, and opened her laptop. She added what she now knew to the notes she had taken during her telephone conversation with Alec Pelly. She stared at the screen, and as she scrolled back and forth, an old saying of her mother's popped into her head. Macy's doesn't tell Gimbel's. The police in Dayton didn't know about Frank Peterson's murder, and the police in Flint City didn't know about the murders of the Howard sisters. Why would they? The killings had taken place in different regions of the country and months apart. No one knew that Terry Maitland had been in both places, and no one knew about the connection to the Heisman Memory Unit. Every case had an information highway running through it, and this one was washed out in at least two places. But I know, Holly said. At least some of it. I do. Only... The knock at the door made her jump. She let in the room service waiter, signed the check, added a 10% tip after making sure a service gratuity was not included, and hustled him out. Then she paced the room, munching away at a BLT she hardly tasted. What didn't she know that could be known? She was bothered, almost haunted, by the idea that the puzzle she was trying to work had missing pieces. Not because Alec Pelly had purposely held things back. She didn't think that at all. But possibly because there was information, vital information, that he considered unimportant. She supposed she could call Mrs. Maitland. Only the woman would cry and be all sad, and Holly wouldn't know how to comfort her. She never did. Once, not so long ago, she had helped Jerome Robinson's sister through a bad patch, but as a rule, she was terrible at things like that. Plus, the poor woman's mind would be fogged by her grief, and she also might neglect important facts, those little things that could make a whole picture out of the fragments, like the three or four jigsaw pieces that always seemed to fall off the table and onto the floor, and you couldn't see the whole picture until you hunted around and found them. The person most apt to know all the details, the small ones as well as the big ones, was the detective who had done most of the witness interviews and arrested Maitland. After working with Bill Hodges, Holly believed in police detectives. Not all of them were good, to be sure. She'd had little respect for Isabel Janes, Pete Huntley's partner, after Bill had retired from the force. And this one, Ralph Anderson, had made a bad mistake by arresting Maitland in a public place. A bad choice didn't necessarily make him a bad detective, though. And Pelly had explained the crucial mitigating circumstance. Terry Maitland had been in close contact with Anderson's son. Certainly the interviews Anderson had done seemed thorough enough. She thought he was the one most likely to have any missing pieces. It was something to think about. In the meantime, a return visit to the Heisman Memory Unit was in order. 7. She arrived at 2:30, this time driving around to the left side of the building, where signs announced employee parking and keep ambulance bay clear. She chose a space at the far end of the lot, backing in so she could watch the building. By 2:45, cars began to drift in as those working the 3-to-11 shift arrived. Around 3, the day shift employees, mostly orderlies, some nurses, a couple of guys in suits, which probably made them doctors, began to leave. One of the suits drove away in a Cadillac, the other in a Porsche. They were doctors, all right. She evaluated the others carefully and settled on a target. She was a middle-aged nurse wearing a tunic covered with dancing teddy bears. Her car was an old Honda Civic with rust on the sides, a cracked taillight that had been mended with duct tape, and a fading "I'm with Hillary" sticker on the bumper. Before getting in, she paused to light a cigarette. The car was old, and cigarettes were expensive. Better and better. Holly followed her out of the parking lot, then 3 miles west, the city giving way first to a pleasant suburb, then to one not so pleasant. Here, the woman turned into the driveway of a tract house on a street where others, just like it, stood almost hip to hip, many with cheap plastic toys marooned on the little patches of lawn. Holly parked at the curb, said a brief prayer for strength, patience, and wisdom, and got out. "Ma'am, nurse, pardon me?" The woman turned. She had the creased face and prematurely gray hair of a heavy smoker, so it was hard to tell her age. Maybe 45, maybe 50. No wedding ring. "Can I help you?" "Yes, and I'll pay for your help," Holly said. $100 in cash. If you'll talk to me about Heath Holmes and his connection to Peter Maitland."
"Did you follow me from my job?"
"Actually, I did." The woman's brows contracted. "Are you a reporter?"
"Mrs. Kelly said there'd be a woman reporter around and promised to fire anyone who talked to her."
"I'm the woman she mentioned, but I'm not a reporter. I'm an investigator, and Mrs. Kelly will never find out you talked to me."
"Let's see some ID."
Holly handed over her driver's license and a finder's keeper's bail bondsman's card. The woman examined them closely, then handed them back. "I'm Candy Wilson. It's nice to meet you."
"Uh-huh. That's good. But if I'm going to put my job on the line for you, it will cost $200. She paused, then added, "and $50.
"All right," Holly said.
She guessed she could talk the woman down to $200, maybe even $150, but she wasn't good at bargaining, which her mother always called haggling. Also, this lady looked like she needed it.
"You better come inside," Wilson said. "The neighbors on this street have long noses."
8. The house smelled strongly of cigarettes, which made Holly really crave one for the first time in ages. Wilson plunked down in an easy chair, which, like her taillight, was mended with duct tape. Beside it was a standing ashtray of a type Holly hadn't seen since her grandfather died of emphysema. Wilson plucked a pack of cigarettes from the pocket of her nylon pants and flicked her Bic. She did not offer the pack to Holly, which was no surprise, given the price of smokes these days, but for which Holly was grateful, anyway. She might have taken one.
"Money first," Candy Wilson said.
Holly, who had not neglected to stop at an ATM on her second trip to the memory unit, took her wallet from her purse and counted out the correct amount. Wilson recounted it, then put it in her pocket with her cigarettes.
"Hope you're telling the truth about keeping your mouth shut, Holly. God knows I need this money. My asshole husband cleaned out our bank account when he left. But Mrs. Kelly doesn't kid around. She's like one of the dragons on that throne show."
Holly once more zipped a thumbnail across her lips and turned the invisible key. Candy Wilson smiled and seemed to relax. She looked around the living room, which was small and dark and furnished in early American yard sale.
"Ugly fucking place, isn't it? We had a nice house over on the west side. No mansion, but better than this pit. My asshole husband sold it right out from under me before he sailed off into the sunset. You know what they say, they are none so blind as those who will not see. I almost wish we'd had kids so I could turn them against him."
Bill would have known how to reply to this, but Holly didn't. So she took out her notebook and went to the matter at hand.
"Heath Holmes worked as an orderly at the Heisman."
"Yes, indeed. Handsome Heath, we used to call him. It was sort of a joke and sort of not. He wasn't any Chris Pine or Tom Hiddleston, but he wasn't hard to look at either. Nice guy, too. Everybody thought so. which only goes to prove that you never know what's in a man's heart. I found that out with my asshole husband, but at least he never raped and mutilated any little girls.
Seen their pictures in the paper. Holly nodded. Two cute blondes, wearing identical pretty smiles. 12 and 10. The exact ages of Terry Maitland's daughters. Another of those things that felt like a connection. Maybe it wasn't, but the whisper that the two cases were actually one had begun to grow louder in Holly's mind. A few more facts of the right kind, and it would become a shout.
"Who does that?" Wilson asked, but the question was rhetorical. "A monster, that's who."
"How long did you work with him, Miss Wilson?"
"Call me Candy, why don't you? I let people call me by my first name when they pay my utilities for the next month. I worked with him for 7 years and never had a clue."
"The paper said he was on vacation when the girls were killed."
"Yeah. Went up to Regis, about 30 miles north of here, to his mother's, who told the cops he was there the whole time." Wilson rolled her eyes.
"The paper also said he had a record."
"Well, yeah, but nothing gross. Just a joyride and a stolen car when he was 17. She frowned at her cigarette. "Paper wasn't supposed to have that, you know. He was a juvenile, and those records are supposed to be sealed. If they weren't, he probably wouldn't have gotten the job at Heisman, even with all his army training and his 5 years working at Walter Reed. Maybe, but probably not."
"You speak as if you knew him pretty well."
"I'm not defending him. Don't get that idea. I had drinks with him, sure, but it wasn't a date situation, nothing like that. A bunch of us used to go out to the Shamrock sometimes after work. This was back when I still had some money and could buy around when it was my turn. Those days are gone, honey. Anyway, we used to call ourselves the Forgetful Five on account of..."
"I think I get it," Holly said.
"Yeah, I bet you do, and we knew all the Alzheimer's jokes. Most of them are kind of mean, and a lot of our patients are actually pretty nice, but we told them to kind of... I don't know."
"Whistle past the graveyard?" Holly suggested.
"Yes, that's it. You want a beer, Holly?"
"Okay, thanks." She didn't have much of a taste for beer, and it wasn't really recommended when you were taking Lexapro, but she wanted to keep the conversation rolling.
Wilson brought back a couple of Bud Lights. She offered Holly a glass, no more than she had offered one of her cigarettes.
"Yeah, I knew about the joyride bust," she said, once more sitting in the mended easy chair. It gave a tired woof. "We all did. You know how people talk when they've had a few. But it was nothing like what he did in April. I still can't believe it. I kissed that guy under the mistletoe at last year's Christmas party."
She either shuddered or pretended to. "So he was on vacation the week of April 23rd.
"If you say so. I just know it was in spring because of my allergies."
So saying, she lit a fresh cigarette.
"Said he was going up to Regis. Said he and his mom were going to have a service for his dad, who died a year ago. A memory service, he called it. And maybe he did go. But he came back to kill those girls from Trotwood, no question about it, because people saw him, and there was surveillance video from a gas station that showed him filling up."
"Filling what up?" Holly asked. "Was it a van?" This was leading the witness, and Bill wouldn't have approved, but she couldn't help herself.
"I don't know. Not sure the papers said. Probably his truck. He had a Tahoe all fancied up. Custom tires. Lots of chrome. And a camper cap. He could have put them in there. Drugged them, maybe, until he was ready to. You know... use them."
"Ook," Holly said. She couldn't help it. Candy Wilson nodded.
"Yeah, kind of thing you don't want to imagine, but you just can't help it. At least I can't. They also found his DNA, as I'm sure you know, because that was in the paper, too."
"Yes."
"And I saw him that week, because he came into work one day. "Just can't stay away from this place, can you?" I asked him. He didn't say anything, just gave me a creepy smile and kept walking down B-Wing. I never saw him smile like that, never. I bet he still had their blood under his fingernails.
Maybe even on his cock and balls. Christ, it gives me the willies just thinking about it. It gave Holly the willies too, but she didn't say so. Only took a sip of her beer and asked what day that had been.
I don't know off the top of my head, but after those girls disappeared, you know what? I bet I can tell you exactly, because I had a hair appointment that same day after work to have it colored. Haven't been to the beauty parlor since, as I'm sure you can plainly see. Just a minute.
She went to a little desk in the corner of the room, came up with an appointment book, and flipped back through the pages.
Here it is. Debbie's Hairport, April 26th.
Holly wrote it down and added an exclamation point. That was the day of Terry's last visit to see his father. He and his family had flown home the following day. Did Peter Maitland know Mr. Holmes?
Wilson laughed. Peter Maitland doesn't really know anybody, hon. He had some clear days last year, and even early this year, he remembered enough to get to the caf on his own and ask for chocolate. The things they really like are the things most of them remember the longest. Now he just sits and stares. If I get that shit, I'm going to take a bunch of pills and die while I still have enough working brain cells to remember what the pills are for. But if you're asking if Heath knew Maitland, the answer is sure. You bet. Some of the orderlies switch around, but Heath stuck pretty much to the odd-numbered suites on B-Wing. He used to say that some part of them knew him, even when most of their brains were gone. And Maitland is in suite B-5.
Did he visit Maitland's room on the day you saw him?
Must have. I know something that wasn't in the paper, but you can bet your ass it would have been a big deal at Heath's trial if he'd ever had one.
What, Candy? What was it? What?
When the cops found out he'd been into the memory unit after the murders, they searched all the B-Wing suites, paying especially close attention to Maitland's, because Cam Malinsky said he saw Heath coming out of there. Cam's a janitor. He noticed Heath especially because Cam was washing the hall floor, and Heath took a slip and went on his ass.
You're sure of this, Candy?
I am. And here's the big thing. My best friend on the nursing staff is a woman named Penny Prudhomme, and she heard one of the cops talking on his phone after they searched B-5. He said they found hair in the room, and it was blonde. What do you think of that?
I think they must have run a DNA test on it to see if it belonged to one of the Howard girls.
Bet your ass they did. CSI stuff.
Those results were never made public, Holly said. Were they?
No. But you know what the cops found in Mrs. Holmes' basement, don't you?
Holly nodded. That detail had been made public, and reading it must have been like putting an arrow in the parents' hearts. Someone had talked, and the paper had printed it. Probably it had been on TV, too.
A lot of sex killers take trophies, Candy said authoritatively. I've seen it on Forensic Files and Dateline. It's common behavior with these wackos.
Although Heath Holmes never seemed like a wacko to you.
They hide it, Candy Wilson said ominously.
But he didn't try very hard to hide this crime, did he? People saw him. And there was even that surveillance video.
So what? He went crazy. And crazy people don't give a shit.
I'm sure Detective Anderson and the Flint County DA said the exact same thing about Terry Maitland, Holly thought, even though some serial killers, sex killers, to use Candy Wilson's term, keep getting away with it for years. Ted Bundy, for one. John Wayne Gacy, for another. Holly got up. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank me by making sure Mrs. Kelly doesn't find out I talked to you.
I'll do that, Holly said. As she was stepping out the door, Candy said,
You know about his mom, right? What she did after Heath offed himself in jail?
Holly stopped, keys in hand. No.
It was a month later. Guess you didn't get that far in your researches. She hung herself, just like him, only in her basement instead of a jail cell.
Holy frack! Did she leave a note?
That I don't know, Candy said, but the basement was where the cops found those bloody underpants. The ones with Winnie and Tigger and Rue on them. If your only son does a thing like that, who needs to leave a note?
9. When Holly was unsure about what to do next, she almost always sought out either an international house of pancakes or a Denny's. Both served breakfast all day, comfort food that you could eat slowly without being bothered by things like wine lists and pushy waiters. She found an IHOP close to her hotel. Once seated at a two-top in the corner, she ordered pancakes, a short stack, a single scrambled egg, and hash browns. The IHOP hash browns were always delicious. While she waited for her food to come, she fired up her laptop and searched for Ralph Anderson's telephone number. She didn't find it, which was no huge surprise. Police officers almost always unlisted their phones. She could almost certainly get to it. Even so, Bill had taught her all the tricks, and she wanted to talk to him because she was sure they both had pieces of the puzzle the other lacked. He's Macy's, I'm Gimbel's, she said.
What was that, hon?
It was the waitress with her evening repast. I was just saying how hungry I am, Holly said.
You better be, because this is a lot of chow.
She set the plates down.
But you could use some feeding up, if you don't mind me saying so. You're too skinny.
I had a friend who used to tell me that all the time, Holly said, and suddenly felt like crying. It was that phrase, I had a friend. Time had passed, and time probably did heal all wounds. But God, some of them healed so slowly. And the difference between I have and I had was such a gulf. She ate slowly, going heavy on the pancake syrup. It wasn't the real deal, not maple, but it was tasty, just the same, and it was good to eat a meal where you sat down and took your time. By the time she finished, she had come to a reluctant decision. Calling Detective Anderson without informing Pelly was apt to get her fired when she wanted, it was Bill's turn of phrase, to chase the case. More importantly, it would be unethical. The waitress came back to offer more coffee, and Holly agreed. You didn't get free refills at Starbucks, and the IHOP coffee, while not gourmet, was good enough. Like the syrup. And like me, Holly thought. Her therapist said these moments of self-validation throughout the day were very important. I may not be Sherlock Holmes, or Tommy and Tuppence for that matter, but I am good enough, and I know what I have to do. Mr. Pelly may argue with me, and I hate arguments, but I'll argue back if I have to. I'll channel my inner Bill Hodges. She held that thought while she made the call. When Pelly answered, she said, Terry Maitland didn't kill the Peterson boy.
What? Did you just say what I think you...
Yes. I've discovered some very interesting things here in Dayton, Mr. Pelly. But before I make my report, I need to talk to Detective Anderson. Do you have any objections? Pelly didn't give her the argument she had dreaded.
I'd have to talk to Howie Gold about that, and he'd have to clear it with Marcy, but I think it will be okay with both of them.
Holly relaxed and sipped her coffee. That's good. Clear it with them as fast as you can, please, and get me his number. I'd like to talk to him tonight.
But why? What have you found out?
Let me ask you a question. Do you know if anything unusual happened at the Heisman Memory Unit on the day Terry Maitland visited his father for the last time?
Unusual like what?
This time Holly didn't lead her witness. Like anything. You may not know, but then again you might. If Terry said something to his wife when he got back to their hotel, for instance. Anything.
No. Unless you mean Terry bumping into an orderly when he went out. The orderly fell down because the floor was wet, but it was just a chance thing. Neither of them was hurt or anything.
She clutched her phone so hard her knuckles creaked. You never said anything like that before.
I didn't think it was important.
That's why I need to talk to Detective Anderson. There are missing pieces. You just gave me one. He may have more. Also, he can find things out that I can't.
Are you saying an excuse-me bump as Maitland was going out has relevance? If so, what is it?
Let me talk to Detective Anderson first. Please. There was a long pause. Then Pelly said,
"Let me see what I can do."
The waitress put down the check as Holly pocketed her phone.
That sounded intense.
Holly gave her a smile. Thank you for such good service. The waitress left. The check came to $18.20. Holly left a $5 tip under her plate. This was quite a bit more than the recommended amount, but she was excited. 10. She had barely returned to her room when her cell rang. Unknown caller, the screen said. Hello? You've reached Holly Gibney. To whom am I speaking?
This is Ralph Anderson. Alec Pelly gave me your number, Ms. Gibney, and told me what you're doing. My first question is, do you know what you're doing?
Yes. Holly had many worries, and she was a very doubtful person, even after years of therapy, but of this much she was sure.
Well, maybe you do, and maybe you don't. I have no way of telling, do I?
No, Holly agreed. At least, not as of this moment.
Alex said you told him Terry Maitland didn't kill Frank Peterson. He said you seemed very sure of it. I'm curious as to how you can make a statement like that when you're in Dayton and the Peterson murder happened here in Flint City.
Because there was a similar crime here, at the same time Maitland was here. Not a boy killed, but two little girls. Same basic MO, rape and mutilation. The man the police arrested claimed to have been staying with his mother in a town 30 miles away. And she corroborated that. But he was also seen in Trotwood, the suburb where the little girls were abducted. There's surveillance footage of him. Does this sound familiar?
Familiar, but not surprising. Most killers toss up some kind of alibi once they're caught. You might not know that from your work collaring bail jumpers, Ms. Gibney. Alec told me what your firm mostly does, but surely you know it from TV.
This man was an orderly at the Heisman Memory Unit, and although he was supposed to be on vacation, he was there at least once during the same week that Mr. Maitland was there visiting his father. On the occasion of Mr. Maitland's last visit, April 26th, this would have been, these two supposed killers actually bumped into each other, and I mean that literally.
Are you shitting me? Anderson nearly shouted.
I am not. This is what my old partner at Finders Keepers would have called an authentic no-shit situation. Is your interest piqued?
Did Pelly tell you the orderly scraped Maitland when he fell down? Reached out and grabbed for him and nicked his arm?
Holly was silent. She was thinking about the movie she had packed in her carry-on. She wasn't in the habit of self-congratulation,
just the opposite, but it now seemed like an act of intuitive genius. Only, had she ever doubted there was something far out of the ordinary about the Maitland case? She had not, mostly because of her association with the monstrous Brady Wilson Harsfield. A thing like that tended to widen your perspective quite a bit.
And that wasn't the only cut.
He sounded like he was talking to himself.
There was another one. But down here, after Frankie Peterson was murdered.
Here was another missing piece. Tell me, detective. Tell me, tell me, tell me.
I think... Not over the phone. Can you fly down here? We should sit down and talk. You, me, Alec Pelley, Howie Gold, and a state police detective who's also been working the case. And maybe Marcy. Her too.
I think that's a good idea. But I'll have to discuss it with my client, Mr. Pelley.
Talk to Howie Gold instead. I'll give you his number.
Protocol?
Howie employs Alec, so protocol isn't an issue.
Holly mulled this over. Can you get in touch with the Dayton Police Department and the Montgomery County District Attorney? I can't find out all I want to know about the murders of the Howard girls and about Heath Holmes. That's the orderly's name. But I think you could.
Is this guy's trial still pending? If it is, they probably won't want to give out a whole lot of info.
Mr. Holmes is dead, she paused. Just like Terry Maitland.
Jesus, he muttered. How weird can this get?
Weirder, she said, another thing of which she had no doubt.
Weirder, he repeated. Maggots in the cantaloupe.
I beg your pardon.
Nothing. Call Mr. Gold, okay?
I still think I had better call Mr. Pelley first, just to be sure.
If you really think so. And Ms. Gibney, I guess maybe you do know your business.
That made her smile. 11. Holly got the green light from Mr. Pelley and called Howie Gold at once, now pacing a worry track on the cheap hotel carpet and obsessively punching at her Fitbit to read her pulse. Yes, Mr. Gold thought it would be a good idea if she flew down, and no, she didn't need to fly coach.
Book business class, he said. More legroom.
All right, she felt giddy. I will.
You really don't believe Terry killed the Peterson boy?
No more than I think Heath Holmes killed those two girls, she said. I think it was someone else. I think it was an outsider. Visits. July 25th. 1.
Detective Jack Hoskins of the Flint City PD woke up at 2 a.m. on that Wednesday morning in triple misery. He had a hangover, he had a sunburn, and he needed to take a shit. It's what I'd get for eating at Los Tres Molinos, he thought. But had he eaten there? He was pretty sure he had. Enchilada stuffed with pork and that spicy cheese. But wasn't positive. It might have been Hacienda. Last night was hazy. Have to cut back on the vodka. Vacation is over. Yes, and over early. Because their shitty little department currently had just one working detective. Sometimes life was a bitch. Often, even. He got out of bed, wincing at the single hard thud in his head when his feet hit the floor and rubbing at the burn on the back of his neck. He shucked his shorts, grabbed a newspaper off the nightstand, and plodded to the bathroom to take care of his business. Ensconced on the toilet, waiting for the semi-liquid gush that always came 6 hours or so after he ate Mexican food, would he never learn? He opened the call and rattled his way to the Comics, the only part of the local paper that was worth a damn. He was squinting at the tiny dialogue balloons in Get Fuzzy when he heard the shower curtain rattle. He looked up and saw a shadow behind the printed daisies. His heart leaped into his throat, walloping. Someone was standing in his tub. An intruder. And not just some stone junky thief who'd wriggled through the bathroom window and taken refuge in the only place available when he saw the bedroom light come on, no. This was the same someone who had been standing behind him at that fucking abandoned barn out in Canning Township. He knew it as surely as he knew his own name. That encounter, if it had been an encounter, refused to leave his mind, and it was almost as if he had been expecting this return. You know that's bullshit. You thought you saw a man in the barn, but when you put the light on, the guy turned out to be nothing but a piece of busted farm equipment. Now you think there's a man in your tub. But what looks like his head is just a shower head, and what looks like his arm is nothing but your long-handled back scrubber stuck through the grab handle on the wall. The rattling sound you heard was either a draft or just in your head. He closed his eyes, opened them again, and stared at the shower curtain with its stupid plastic flowers, the kind of shower curtain only an ex-wife could love. Now that he was fully awake, reality reasserted itself. Just the shower head, just the grab handle with the back scrubber stuck through it. He was an idiot, a hungover idiot, the worst kind. The shower curtain rattled again. It rattled because what he had wanted to believe was his back scrubber now grew shadowy fingers and reached out to touch the plastic. The shower head turned and seemed to stare at him through the translucent curtain. The newspaper fell from Hoskins' relaxing fingers and landed on the tiles with a soft flap. His head was thudding and thudding. The back of his neck was burning and burning. His bowels relaxed, and the small bathroom was filled with the smell of what Jack was suddenly sure had been his last meal. The hand was reaching for the edge of the curtain. In a second, two at most, it would be pulled back and he would be looking at something so horrible it would make his worst nightmare seem like a sweet daydream. No, he whispered. No. He tried to get up from the toilet, but his legs wouldn't support him and his considerable bottom thumped back onto the ring. Please, no, don't. A hand crept around the edge of the curtain, but instead of pulling it back, the fingers only folded around it. Tattooed on those fingers was a word. Can't. Jack. He couldn't reply. He sat naked on the toilet with the last of his shit still dripping and plopping into the bowl, his heart a runaway engine in his chest. He felt that soon it would rip right out of him, and his last sight on earth would be of it lying on the tiles, splattering blood on his ankles and the comic section of the Flint City Call with its final twitching beats.
That's not a sunburn, Jack.
He wanted to faint, to just collapse off the toilet, and if he gave himself a concussion on the tile floor, even fractured his skull, so what?
At least he would be out of this.
But consciousness stubbornly remained. The shadowy figure in the tub remained. The fingers on the curtain remained. Can't, in fading blue letters.
Touch the back of your neck, Jack. If you don't want me to pull back this curtain and show myself, do it now.
Hoskins raised a hand and pressed it to the nape of his neck. His body's reaction was immediate. Terrifying bolts of pain which ran up to his temples and down to his shoulders. He looked at his hand and saw it was smeared with blood.
You've got cancer, the figure behind the curtain informed him. It's in your lymph glands, and your throat, and your sinuses. It's in your eyes, Jack. It's eating into your eyes. Soon you'll be able to see it. Little gray knobs of malignant cancer cells swimming around in your vision. Do you know when you got it?
Of course he knew.
when this creature had touched him out there in Canning Township, when it had caressed him.
I gave it to you, but I can take it back. Would you like me to take it back?
Yes,
Jack whispered.
He began to cry. Take it back. Please take it back.
Will you do something if I ask you?
Yes.
You won't hesitate?
No.
I believe you, and you won't give me any reason not to believe you, will you?
No. No.
Good. Now clean yourself up. You stink. The cant hand withdrew, but the shape behind the shower curtain was still staring at him. Not a man, after all. Something far worse than the worst man who had ever lived.
Hoskins reached for the toilet paper, aware as he did so that he was tilting sideways off the seat and that the world was simultaneously dimming and dwindling.
And that was good. He fell, but there was no pain. He was unconscious before he hit the floor.
2. Jeannie Anderson woke at 4 that morning with her usual wee hours full bladder. Ordinarily, she would have used their bathroom, but Ralph had been sleeping badly ever since Terry Maitland had been shot, and tonight he had been particularly restless. She got out of bed and made her way to the bathroom at the end of the hall, the one past the door to Derek's room. She considered flushing after relieving herself and decided even that might wake him. It could wait until morning.
2 more hours, Lord, she thought as she left the bathroom. 2 more hours of good sleep, that's all I wa— She stopped halfway down the hall. The downstairs had been dark when she left the bedroom, hadn't it? She had been more asleep than awake, but surely she would have noticed a light on.
Are you sure of that?
No, not completely, but there certainly was a light on down there now. White light, muted. The one over the stove. She went to the stairs and stood at the top, looking down at that light, brow wrinkled, thinking profoundly. Had the burglar alarm been set before they went to bed? Yes. Arming it before bed was a house rule. She said it and Ralph had double-checked it before they went up. One or the other of them always set the alarm, but the double checks, like Ralph's poor sleeping, had only begun since the death of Terry Maitland. She considered waking Ralph and decided against it. He needed his sleep. She considered going back to get his service revolver, in the box on the high shelf in the closet. But the closet door squeaked, and that would surely wake him, and wasn't that pretty paranoid? The light probably had been on when she went to the bathroom, and she just hadn't noticed. Or maybe it had gone on by itself, a malfunction. She descended the steps quietly, moving to the left on the third step and to the right on the ninth to avoid the creaks, not even thinking about it. She walked to the kitchen door and peeked around the frame, feeling both stupid and not stupid at all. She sighed, blowing back her bangs. The kitchen was empty. She started across the room to turn off the stove light, then stopped. There were supposed to be 4 chairs at the kitchen table, 3 for the family, and the one they called the guest chair, but now there were only 3. Don't move, someone said. If you move, I'll kill you. If you scream, I'll kill you. She stopped, pulse hammering. The hair on the back of her neck lifting. If she hadn't done her business before coming down, urine would be running down her legs and puddling on the floor. The man, the intruder, was sitting on the guest chair in their living room, just far enough back from the archway that she could only see him from the knees down. He was wearing faded jeans and moccasins with no socks. His ankles were riddled with red blotches, that might have been psoriasis. His upper body was just a vague silhouette. All she could tell was that his shoulders were broad and a little slumped, not as if he was tired, but as if they were so crammed with workout muscle that he couldn't square them. It was funny all you could see at a moment like this. Terror had frozen her brain's usual sorting ability, and everything flowed in without prejudice. This was the man who had killed Frank Peterson, the man who bit into him like a wild animal and raped him with a tree branch. That man was in her house, and here she stood in her shorty pajamas, with her nipples no doubt sticking out like headlights.
"Listen to me," he said. "Are you listening?"
"Yes," Jeannie whispered, but she had begun to sway on the edge of a faint, and she was afraid she might pass out before he could say what he'd come to say. If that happened, he would kill her. After that, he might leave or he might go upstairs to kill Ralph. He'd do it before Ralph's mind cleared enough to know what was going on, and leave Derek to come home from camp an orphan. "No, no, no! What do you want?"
"Tell your husband it's done here in Flint City. Tell him he has to stop. Tell him that if he does that, things go back to normal. Tell him if he doesn't, I'll kill him. I'll kill them all."
His hand emerged from the shadows of the living room and into the dim light cast by the single bar fluorescent. It was a big hand. He closed it into a fist.
"What does it say on my fingers? Read it to me."
She stared at the faded blue letters. She tried to speak and couldn't. Her tongue was nothing but a lump clinging to the roof of her mouth. He leaned forward. She saw eyes under a broad shelf of forehead. Black hair, short enough to bristle. Black eyes, not just on her, but in her,
searching her heart and mind. "It says, must," he told her. "You see that, don't you?"
Yeah.
"And what you must do is tell him to stop."
Red lips moving inside a black goatee.
"Tell him if he or any of them tries to find me, I'll kill them and leave their guts in the desert for the buzzard. Do you understand me?"
"Yes," she tried to tell him, but her tongue wouldn't move and her knees were unlocking, and she put her arms out to break her fall, and she didn't know if she succeeded in that or not, because she was gone into darkness before she hit the floor.
3. Jack woke up at 7 o'clock with bright summer sun shining through the window and across his bed. Birds were twittering outside. He sat bolt upright, staring wildly around, only faintly aware that his head was throbbing from last night's vodka. He got out of bed fast, opened the drawer of his bedside table, and took out the .38 Pathfinder he kept there for home protection. He high-stepped across the bedroom with the gun held beside his right cheek and the short barrel pointing at the ceiling. He kicked his boxers aside, and when he got to the door, which stood open, he paused next to it with his back to the wall. The smell wafting out was fading but familiar, the aftermath of last night's enchilada adventures. He had gotten up to offload, that much at least hadn't been a dream. "Is anybody in there? If so, answer up. I'm armed and I will shoot." Nothing. Jack took a deep breath and pivoted around the doorframe, going low, sweeping the room from side to side with the barrel of the .38. He saw the toilet with the lid up and the ring down. He saw the newspaper on the floor, turned to the comics. He saw the tub with its translucent flowered curtain pulled across. He saw shapes behind it, but those were the shower head, the grab handle, the back scrubber.
"Are you sure?"
Before he could lose his nerve, he took a step forward, slid on the bath mat, and grabbed the shower curtain to keep from going ass over teapot. It pulled loose from the rings and covered his face. He screamed, clawed it aside, and pointed the .38 into the tub at nothing. No one there. No boogeyman. He peered at the bottom of the tub. He wasn't exactly conscientious about keeping it clean, and if someone had been standing in there, he would have left footprints. But the dried scum of soap and shampoo was unmarked by tracks. It had all been a dream. A particularly vivid nightmare. Still, he checked the bathroom window and all three doors leading outside. Everything was buttoned up. Okay, then. Time to relax. Or almost. He went back to the bathroom for one more look, this time checking the towel cabinet. Nothing. And toying at the fallen shower curtain with disgust. Time to replace that sucker. He'd swing by Home Depot today. He reached absently to rub the back of his neck and hissed with pain as soon as his fingers made contact. He went to the sink and turned around, but trying to see the back of your neck by looking over your shoulder was worse than useless. He opened the top drawer under the sink and found nothing but shaving stuff, combs, an unraveling ace bandage, and the world's oldest tube of Monistat. Another little souvenir from the age of Greta, like the stupid shower curtain. In the bottom drawer, he found what he was looking for, a mirror with a broken handle. He rubbed the dust from its reflective surface, backed up until his butt was touching the lip of the sink, and held up the mirror. The back of his neck was flaming red, and he could see little seed pearl blisters forming. How was that possible? When he slathered himself with sunblock as a matter of course and didn't have a sunburn anywhere else.
That's not a sunburn, Jack.
Hoskins made a little whimpering sound. Surely no one had been in his tub early this morning. No creepy weirdo with "can't" tattooed on his fingers. Surely not. But one thing was certain. Skin cancer ran in his family. His mother and one of his uncles had died of it. "It goes with the red hair," his father had said, after he himself had had skin tags removed from his driver's sidearm, precancerous moles from his calves, and a basal cell carcinoma from the back of his neck. Jack remembered a huge black mole growing, always growing on his Uncle Jim's cheek. He remembered the raw sores on his mother's breastbone and eating into her left arm. Your skin was the largest organ in your body, and when it went haywire, the results were not pretty.
"Would you like me to take it back?"
the man behind the curtain had asked. "That was a dream," Hoskins said. "I got a scare out in Canyon last night. I ate a shitload of bad Mexican food, so I had a nightmare. That's all. End of story."
That didn't stop him from feeling for lumps in his armpits, under the angles of his jaw, inside his nose.
Nothing. Only a little too much sun on the back of his neck. Except he had no sunburn anywhere else. Just that single throbbing stripe. He wasn't actually bleeding, which sort of proved his early morning encounter had only been a bad dream, but it was already growing that crop of blisters. He should probably see a doctor about it, and he would, after he gave it a few days to get better on its own, that was.
"Will you do something if I ask you? You won't hesitate?"
No one would, Jack thought, looking at the back of his neck in the mirror, if the alternative was getting eaten from the outside in, eaten alive. No one would.
4. Jeannie woke up staring at the bedroom ceiling, at first not able to understand why her mouth was filled with the coppery taste of panic, as if she had narrowly avoided a bad fall, or why her hands were raised, palms splayed out in a warding off gesture. And then she saw the empty half of the bed on her left, heard the sound of Ralph splashing in the shower, and thought, it was a dream. The most vivid damn nightmare of all time, for sure.
That's all it was. Only there was no sense of relief, because she didn't believe that. It wasn't fading, as dreams usually did on waking, even the worst ones. She remembered everything, from seeing the light on downstairs to the man sitting in the guest chair just beyond the living room archway. She remembered the hand emerging into the dim light and closing into a fist so she could read the fading letters tattooed between the knuckles. Must.
What you must do is tell him to stop.
She threw back the covers and left the room, not quite running. In the kitchen, the light over the stove was off, and all four chairs were in their accustomed places at the table where they ate most of their meals. It should have made a difference. It didn't.
5. When Ralph came down, tucking his shirt into his jeans with one hand and holding his sneakers in the other, he found his wife sitting at the kitchen table. There was no morning cup of coffee in front of her, no juice, no cereal. He asked her if she was okay.
No. There was a man here last night.
He stopped where he was, one side of his shirt squared away, the other hanging down over his belt. He dropped his sneakers. Say what?
A man. The one who killed Frank Peterson.
He looked around, suddenly wide awake. When? What are you talking about?
Last night. He's gone now, but he had a message for you. Sit down, Ralph.
He did, and she told him what had happened. He listened without saying a word, looking into her eyes. He saw nothing in them but absolute conviction. When she was done, he got up to check the burglar alarm console by the back door. It's armed, Jeannie, and the door's locked. At least this one is.
I know it's armed, and they're all locked. I checked. The windows are, too.
Then how?
I don't know, but he was here.
Sitting right there. He pointed to the archway.
Yes, as if he didn't want to get too far into the light.
And he was big, you say?
Yes, maybe not as big as you. I couldn't tell his height because he was sitting down, but he had broad shoulders and lots of muscle, like a guy who spends 3 hours a day in a gym or lifting weights in a prison yard.
He left the table and got down on his knees where the kitchen's wooden floor met the living room carpet. She knew what he was looking for, and knew he wouldn't find it. She had checked this, too, and it didn't change her mind. If you weren't crazy, you knew the difference between dreams and reality, even when the reality was far outside the boundaries of normal life. Once she might have doubted that, as she knew Ralph was doubting now, but no more. Now, she knew better. He got up. That's a new carpet, honey. If a man had sat there, even for a short while, the feet of the chair would have left marks in the nap. There aren't any. She nodded.
I know, but he was there.
What are you saying? That he was a ghost?
I don't know what he was, but I know he was right. You have to stop. If you don't, something bad is going to happen. She went to him, tilting her head up to look him full in the face. Something terrible.
He took her hands. This has been a stressful time, Jeannie, for you as much as for me. She pulled away. Don't go there, Ralph. Don't. He was here. For the sake of argument, say he was. I've been threatened before. Any cop worth his salt has been threatened. You're not the only one being threatened. She had to struggle not to shout. This was like being caught in one of those ridiculous horror movies where no one believes the heroine when she says Jason or Freddy or Michael Myers has come back yet again. He was in our house. He thought about going over it again. Locked doors, locked windows, burglar alarm, armed but quiet. He thought about reminding her that she had awakened this morning in her own bed, safe and sound. He could see by her face that none of those things would do any good, and an argument with his wife in her current state was the last thing he wanted.
Was he burned, Jeannie, like the man I saw at the courthouse? She shook her head. You sure? Because you said he was in the shadows.
He leaned forward at one point, and I saw a little. I saw enough. She shuddered. Broad forehead, shelving over his eyes. The eyes themselves were dark. Maybe black, maybe brown, maybe deep blue. I couldn't tell. His hair was short and bristly. Some gray, but most of it still black. He had a goatee. His lips were very red. The description struck a chime in his head, but Ralph didn't trust the feeling. It was probably a false positive caused by her intensity. God knew he wanted to believe her. If there had been one single scrap of empirical evidence...
Wait a minute. His feet. He was wearing moccasins without socks, and there were these red blotches all over them. I thought it was psoriasis, but I suppose it could have been burns.
He started the coffee maker. I don't know what to tell you, Jeannie. You woke up in bed and there's just no sign anyone was...
Once upon a time, you cut open a cantaloupe and it was full of maggots, she said. That happened. You know it did. Why can't you believe this happened?
Even if I did, I couldn't stop. Don't you see that?
What I see is that the man sitting in our living room was right about one thing. It's over. Frank Peterson is dead. Terry is dead. You'll get back on active duty and we can... could...
She trailed off because what she saw in his face made it clear that going on would be useless. It wasn't disbelief. It was disappointment that she could possibly believe moving on was an option for him. Arresting Terry Maitland at the Estelle Barga ball field had been the first domino, the one that started a chain reaction of violence and misery. And now he and his wife were having an argument over the man who wasn't there. All his fault. That's what he believed.
If you won't stop, she said, you need to start carrying your gun again. I know I'll be carrying the little 22 you gave me 3 years ago. I thought it was a very stupid present at the time, but I guess you were right. Hey, maybe you were clairvoyant.
Jeannie, do you want eggs?
I guess so, yeah.
He wasn't hungry, but if all he could do for her this morning was eat her cooking, then that was what he would do. She got the eggs out of the fridge and spoke to him without turning around.
I want us to have police protection at night. It doesn't have to be from dusk to dawn, but I want somebody making regular passes. Can you arrange that?
Police protection against a ghost won't do much good, he thought, but had been married too long to say.
I believe I can. You should tell Howie Gold and the others, too, even if it sounds crazy.
Honey, but she rode over him.
He said you or any of them. He said he'd leave your guts strewn in the desert for the buzzards.
Ralph thought of reminding her that while they did see the occasional buzzard wheeling in the sky, especially on garbage day, there wasn't much in the way of desert around Flint City. That alone was suggestive that the whole encounter had been a dream, but he kept quiet on this as well. He had no intention of winding things up again just when they seemed to be winding down. I will, he said, and this was a promise he meant to keep. They needed to put it all out on the table, every bit of the crazy. You know we're having the meeting at Howie Gold's office, right? With the woman Alec Pelley hired to look into Terry's trip to Dayton?
The one who stated categorically that Terry was innocent.
This time, what Ralph thought of and didn't say, there were oceans of unspoken conversation in long marriages, it seemed, was Uri Geller stated categorically that he could bend spoons by concentrating on them. Yes, she's flying in. Maybe it will turn out that she's full of shit, but she worked with a decorated ex-cop in that business of hers, and her procedure seemed sound enough, so maybe she really found something in Dayton. God knows she sounded sure of herself.
Jeannie began to crack eggs. You'd go on even if I'd come downstairs and found the burglar alarm had been shorted out, the back door was standing open, and his footprints were on the tile. You'd go on even then.
Yes. She deserved the truth, unvarnished.
She turned to him then, the spatula held high like a weapon. "May I say that I think you're being sort of a fool?"
"You can say anything you want, but you need to remember two things, honey. Whether Terry was innocent or guilty, I played a part in getting him killed."
"You..."
"Hush," he said, pointing at her. "I'm talking, and you need to understand." She hushed. "And if he was innocent, there's a child killer out there, running free."
"I understand that, but you may be opening the door on things far beyond your ability to understand, or mine."
"Supernatural things? Is that what you're talking about? Because I can't believe that. I will never believe that."
"Believe what you want," she said, turning back to the stove. "But that man was here. I saw his face, and I saw the word on his fingers. Must. He was dreadful. It's the only word I can think of. Having you not believe me makes me want to cry, or throw the skillet of eggs at your head, or... I don't know."
He went to her and encircled her waist. "I believe that you believe. That much is true. And here's a promise. If nothing comes of this meeting tonight, you'll find me a lot more open to the idea of letting this go. I understand there are limits. Does that work?"
"I guess it has to, at least for now. I know you made a mistake at the ball field. I know you're trying to atone for it. But what if you're making a worse mistake by keeping on?"
"Suppose it had been Derek in Figgis Park," he countered. "Would you want me to let it go then?" She resented the question, considered it a low blow, but had no answer for it. Because if it had been Derek, she would have wanted Ralph to pursue the man who'd done it, or the thing, to the ends of the earth, and she would have been right beside him. "Okay, you win. But one more thing, and it's non-negotiable."
"What?"
"When you go to that meeting tonight, I'm going to be with you. And don't give me any crap about it being police business, because we both know it's not. Now eat your eggs."
6. Jeannie sent Ralph to Kroger with a grocery list because no matter who had been in the house last night, human, ghost, or just a character in an extraordinarily vivid dream, Mr. and Mrs. Anderson still had to eat. And halfway to the supermarket, things came together for Ralph. There was nothing dramatic about it, because the salient facts had been there all along, literally right in front of his face, in a police department interview room. Had he interviewed Frank Peterson's real killer as a witness, thanked him for his help, and let him walk free? It seemed impossible, given the wealth of evidence tying Terry to the murder, but... He pulled over and called Yoon Sablo.
"I'll be there tonight, don't worry," Yoon said. "Wouldn't miss all the news from the Ohio end of this clusterfuck. And I'm already on Heath Holmes. I don't have much yet, but by the time we get together, I should have a fair amount."
"Good, but that's not why I'm calling. Can you pull Claude Bolton's rap sheet? He's the bouncer, gentlemen, please. What you're going to find is possession, mostly, maybe one or two busts for possession with intent to sell, pleaded down."
"He's the one who prefers to be called security, right?"
"Yes, sir, that's our Claude."
"What's up with him?"
"I'll tell you tonight, if it comes to anything. For now, all I can say is that there seems to be a chain of events that leads from Holmes to Maitland to Bolton. I could be wrong, but I don't think I am."
"You're killing me here, Ralph. Tell."
"Not yet. Not until I'm sure. And I need something else. Bolton's a tattoo billboard, and I'm pretty sure he had something on his fingers. I should have noticed, but you know how it is when you're interviewing, especially if the guy on the other side of the table has a record.
You keep your eyes on the face."
"That's right, always on the face, because when guys like Bolton start lying, they might as well be holding up a sign reading, 'I'm full of shit.'"
"You think Bolton was lying when he talked about Maitland coming in to use the phone? Because the taxi driver lady sort of corroborated his story."
"I didn't think so at the time, but now I've got a little more. See if you can find out what was on his fingers, if anything."
"What do you think might be on them, S.A.?"
"Don't want to say, but if I'm right,
It'll be on his sheet. One other thing, can you email me a picture?
Happy to do it. Give me a few minutes.
Thanks, Yoon.
Any plans to get in touch with Mr. Bolton?
Not yet. I don't want him to know I'm interested in him.
And you really are going to explain all this tonight?
As much as I can, yes.
Will it help?
Honest answer? I don't know. Have you got anything back on the stuff you found on the clothes and hay in that barn?
Not yet. Let me see what I can find on Bolton.
Thanks.
What are you up to right now?
Grocery shopping.
Hope you remembered your wife's coupons.
Ralph smiled and looked at the rubber-banded stack on the seat beside him. As if she'd let me forget, he said. 7. He came out of Kroger with 3 bags of groceries, stowed them in the trunk, then looked at his phone. 2 messages from Yoon Sablo. He opened the one with the photo attachment first. In his mugshot, Claude Bolton looked much younger than the man Ralph had interviewed prior to the Maitland arrest. He also looked stoned to the gills, 1,000-yard stare, scraped cheek, and something on his chin that might have been egg or puke. Ralph remembered Bolton saying he went to Narcotics Anonymous these days and that he'd been clean for 5 or 6 years. Maybe so, maybe not. The attachment on Yoon's second email was the arrest record. There were plenty of busts, mostly minor, and plenty of identifying marks. They included a scar on his back, one on his left side below the rib cage, one on his right temple, and about 2 dozen tattoos. There was an eagle, a knife with a bloody tip, a mermaid, a skull with candles in the eye sockets, and a good many others that didn't interest Ralph. What did were the words on his fingers. Can't on the right hand, must on the left. The burned man at the courthouse had had tattoos on his fingers, but had they been can't and must? Ralph closed his eyes and tried to see, but got nothing. He knew from experience that finger tattoos weren't uncommon among men who had spent time in jail. They probably saw it in the movies. Love and hate were popular. So were good and evil. He remembered Jack Hoskins telling him about a rat-faced little burglar who'd been sporting fuck and suck on his digits. Jack saying it probably wasn't the kind of thing that would get the guy girlfriends. The one thing Ralph was sure of was there hadn't been any tats on the burned man's arms. There were plenty of them on Claude Bolton's. But of course the fire that had wrecked the burned guy's face might have erased them. Only no way was that man at the courthouse Bolton, he said, opening his eyes and staring at the people going in and out of the supermarket. Impossible. Bolton wasn't burned. How weird can this get? He had asked the Gibney woman on the phone last night. Weirder, she had replied, and how right she had been. 8. He and Jeannie put the groceries away together. When the chore was done, he told her he wanted her to look at something on his phone.
Why?
Just take a look, okay? And remember that the person in the photo is quite a bit older now. He handed her his phone.
She stared at the mugshot for 10 seconds, then handed it back. Her cheeks had lost all their color. It's him. His hair is shorter now. And he's got a full goatee instead of that little mustache. But that's the man who was in our house last night. The one who said he'd kill you if you didn't stop. What's his name?
Claude Bolton.
Are you going to arrest him?
Not yet. Not sure I could, even if I wanted to, being on administrative leave and all.
Then what are you going to do?
Right now? Find out where he is? His first thought was to call Yoon back, but Yoon was digging away on the Dayton killer, Holmes. His second idea, quickly rejected, was Jack Hoskins. The man was a drunk and a blabbermouth. But there was a third choice. He called the hospital, was informed that Betsy Riggins had gone home with her little bundle of joy, and reached her there. After asking how the new baby was doing, thus provoking a 10-minute rundown on everything from breastfeeding to the high cost of Pampers, he asked her if she would mind helping a brother out by making a call or maybe two in her official capacity. He told her what he wanted. "Is this about Maitland?" she asked. "Well, Betsy, considering my current situation, that's sort of a don't-ask-don't-tell kind of deal. If it is, you could get in trouble, and I could get in trouble for helping you. If it's Chief Geller you're worried about, he won't hear it from me." There was a long pause. He waited her out. Finally, she said, "I felt bad for Maitland's wife, you know. Really bad. She made me think of those TV news stories about the aftermath of suicide bombings. Survivors walking around with blood in their hair and no idea of what just happened. Could this maybe help her out?"
"It's possible," he said. "I don't want to go any further than that."
"Let me see what I can do. John Zellman isn't a total asshole, and that town line titty bar of his needs a new license to operate every year. That might incline him to be helpful. I'll call you back if I strike out. If it goes the way I think it will, he'll call you."
"Thanks, Betsy."
"This stays between us, Ralph. I'm counting on having a job to come back to when my maternity leave is over. Tell me you hear that."
"Loud and clear."
9. John Zellman, owner and operator of Gentleman Please, called Ralph 15 minutes later. He sounded curious rather than irritated and was willing to help. Yes, he was sure Claude Bolton had been at the club when that poor kid had been grabbed and killed.
"Why so positive, Mr. Zellman? I thought he didn't go on duty until 4 p.m.
"Yeah, but he came in early that day. Around 2. He wanted time off to go to the big city with one of the strippers. He said she had a personal problem."
Zellman snorted. He was the one with a personal problem right under his zipper.
"Gal named Carla Jeppesen?" Ralph asked, scrolling through the transcript of Bolton's interview on his iPad. "Also known as Pixie Dreamboat?"
"That's her," Zellman said and laughed. "If no tits count for shit, that old girl's gonna be around for a long time. But some men kinda like that, don't ask me why. Her and Claude have got a thing, but it won't last long. Her husband's in McAllister now. Bad checks, I think. But he'll be out by Christmas. She's just passing the time with Claude. I told him that, but you know what they say. A foreskin just wants to get in."
"You're sure that was the day he came in early? July 10th.
"Sure I am. Made a note of it, because no way was Claude going to get paid for 2 days in Cap City when he had his vacation coming right up. With pay, mind you, less than 2 weeks later.
Kind of outrageous. Did you consider firing him?"
"No. At least he was honest about it, you know. Now listen, Claude's one of the good ones, and they're scarcer than hen's teeth. Mostly security guys are either pussies who look tough but don't want anything to do with a brawl if one breaks out in front of the runway, as they sometimes do, or guys who want to go all Incredible Hulk every time some customer gives them a little lip. Claude can throw somebody out with the best of them when he has to, but most times he doesn't. He's good at quieting them down. He's got a touch. I think it's on account of all those meetings he goes to."
"Narcotics Anonymous, he told me."
"Yeah, he's upfront about it. Proud, actually, and I guess he's got a right to be. A lot of guys never get that monkey off their backs once it climbs on. It's a tough monkey. Long claws."
"Staying clean, is he?"
"If he wasn't, I could tell. I know from junkies, Detective Anderson, believe me. A gentleman is a clean place."
Ralph had his doubts, but let it pass.
"No slips?"
Zellman laughed. "They all slip, at least in the beginning, but not since he's been working for me. He doesn't drink, either. I asked him why not once, if drugs were his problem. He said both things were the same. Said if he took a drink, even an O'Doul's, he'd be off looking for blow or something even stronger."
Zellman paused and said,
"Maybe he was a douche when he was using, but he isn't now. He's decent. In a business where your trade comes to drink margaritas and stare at shaved pussies, that's kind of rare."
"I hear you. Is Bolton on vacation now?"
"Yup. As of Sunday, 10 days.
"Is that what you might call a staycation?"
"You mean, is he here in FC? No, he's down in Texas, somewhere near Austin.
It's where he's from. Hold on a second. I pulled his file before I called you.
There was the sound of shuffling papers. Then Zellman was back.
Marysville, that's the name of the town. Just a wide spot in the road from the way he talks about it. I got the address because I send part of his paycheck down there every other week. It goes to his mother. She's old and pretty feeble. Got the emphysema, too. Claude went down to see if he could get her into one of those assisted living places, but he wasn't too hopeful. Says she's one stubborn old nanny goat. I don't see how he can afford it anyway on what he makes up here. When it comes to taking care of old people, the government should help regular guys like Claude, but does it? Bullshit it does,
says the man who probably voted for Donald Trump, Ralph thought.
Well, thank you, Mr. Zellman. Can I ask why you want to talk to him?
Just a couple of follow-up questions, Ralph said.
Small stuff. Dotting I's and crossing T's, huh?
That's right. Do you have an address?
Sure, to send the money. Got a pencil?
What he had was his trusty iPad open to the Quick Notes app.
Shoot. Box 397, Rural Star, Route 2, Marysville, Texas.
And what's Mom's name?
Zellman laughed cheerfully. Lovey. Ain't that a good one? Lovey Ann Bolton.
Ralph thanked him and hung up. Well, Jeannie asked. Hang on, Ralph said. Notice I've got my think face on.
Ah, so you do. Could you use an iced tea while you think?
She was smiling. It looked good on her, that smile. It looked like a step in the right direction.
No doubt.
He returned to his iPad, wondering how he had ever gotten along without the damn thing, and found Marysville about 70 miles west of Austin. It was little more than a dot on the map. Its single claim to fame, something called the Marysville Hole. Ralph considered his next move while he drank his iced tea, then called Horace Kinney of the Texas Highway Patrol. Kinney was now a captain, mostly riding a desk, but Ralph had worked with him several times on interstate cases when the man had been a trooper, logging 90,000 miles a year in North and West Texas.
Horace, he said after they'd finished with the pleasantries, I need a favor. Big or small?
Medium. And it requires a bit of delicacy.
Kinney laughed. Oh, you need to go to New York or Connecticut for delicacy, hoss. This is Texas. What do you need?
Ralph told him. Kinney said he had just the man, and he happened to be in the area.
10. Around 3 o'clock that afternoon, Flint City PD dispatcher Sandy McGill looked up to see Jack Hoskins standing in front of her desk with his back turned.
Jack, did you need something?
Take a look at the back of my neck and tell me what you see.
Puzzled but willing, she stood up and looked.
Turn to the light a little more.
And when he did so,
ow, that's one hell of a sunburn. You should go down to the Walgreens and get some aloe vera cream.
Will that fix it?
Only time will fix it, but it will take some of the sting out.
But a sunburn is all it is, right?
She frowned.
Sure, but bad enough to have blistered in places. Don't you know enough to put on sunblock when you're out fishing? Do you want to get skin cancer?
Just hearing her say those words out loud made the back of his neck feel hotter.
I guess I forgot.
How bad is it on your arms?
Not quite so bad. No burn on them at all, in fact. It was just on the back of his neck, where someone had touched him out at that abandoned barn, caressed him with just his fingertips.
Thanks, Sandy.
Blondes and redheads get it the worst. If it doesn't get better, you should get it looked at.
He left without replying, thinking of the man in his dream, the one lurking behind the shower curtain.
I gave it to you, but I can take it back. Would you like me to take it back?
He thought it would go away on its own, like any other sunburn.
Maybe so, maybe not. And it really did hurt worse now. He could hardly bear to touch it, and he kept thinking of the open sores eating into his mother's flesh. At first the cancer had crawled, but once it really took hold, it galloped. By the end, it was eating into her throat and vocal cords,
turning her screams into growls. But listening through the closed door of her sick room, 11-year-old Jack Hoskins had still been able to hear what she was telling his father to put her out of her misery. "You'd do it for a dog," she'd croaked. "Why won't you do it for me?"
"Just a sunburn," he said, starting his car. "That's all it is, a fucking sunburn." He needed a drink. 11. It was 5 that afternoon when a Texas Highway Patrol car drove up Rural Star Route 2 and turned into the driveway at Box 397. Lovey Bolton was on her front porch with a cigarette in her hand and her oxygen tank in its rubber-wheeled carrier beside her rocking chair.
"Claude," she rasped, "we got a visitor. It's the state patrol. Better come on round here and see what he wants."
Claude was in the weedy backyard of the little shotgun house, taking in wash off the line and folding it neatly into a wicker basket. Ma's washing machine was all right, but the dryer had shit to bed shortly before he arrived, and these days she was too short of breath to hang out the clothes herself. He meant to buy her a new dryer before he left, but kept putting it off. And now, the THP, unless Ma was wrong, and she probably wasn't. She had plenty of problems, but her eyes were fine. He walked around the house and saw a tall cop getting out of a black-and-white SUV. At the sight of the gold Texas logo on the driver's side door, Claude felt his gut tighten. He hadn't done anything for which he could be arrested in a long, long time, but that tightening was a reflex. Claude reached into his pocket and grabbed his 6-year N.A. medallion, as he often did in moments of stress, hardly aware he was doing it. The trooper tucked his sunglasses into his breast pocket as Ma struggled to rise from her rocker. "No, ma'am, don't get up," he said. "I'm not worth it."
She cackled rustily and settled back. "It's you, some big one. What's your name, officer?"
"Sipe, ma'am. Corporal Owen Sipe. I'm pleased to meet you." He shook the hand, not holding the cigarette, minding the old lady's swollen joints.
"Same goes right back, sir. This is my son, Claude. He's down from Flint City, kind of helping me out."
Sipe turned to Claude, who let go of his chip and held out his own hand. "Pleased to meet you, Mr. Bolton." He held on to Claude's hand for a moment, studying it. "Got a little ink on your fingers, I see." "Got to see both to get the whole message," Claude said. He held out the other hand. "I did 'em myself in jail. But if you're here to see me, you probably know that." "Can't and must," Trooper Sipe said, ignoring the question. "I've seen finger tattoos before, but never those." "Well, they tell a story," Claude said, "and I pass it on when I can. It's how I make amends. I'm clean these days, but it was a hard struggle. Went to a lot of AA and NA meetings while I was locked up. First it was just because they had donuts from Krispy Kreme, but eventually what they were saying took hold. I learned that every addict knows two things. He can't use, and he must use. That's a knot in your head, see? You can't cut it, and you can't untie it, so you have to learn to rise above it. It can be done, but you have to remember the basic situation. You must, but you can't." "Huh," Sipe said. "Sort of a parable, isn't it?"
"These days he don't drink nor drug," Lovey said from a rocker. "He don't even use this shit."
She cast the stub of her cigarette into the dirt.
"He's a good boy."
"I'm not here because anyone thinks he's done something bad," Sipe said mildly, and Claude relaxed. A little. He never wanted to relax too much when the state patrol swung by for an unexpected visit. "Got a call from Flint City. Closing out a case would be my best guess, and they need you to verify something about a man named Terry Maitland." Sipe brought out his phone, diddled with it, and showed Claude a picture. "Is this a belt buckle the Maitland fellow was wearing the night you saw him? And don't ask me what that means, because I sure don't know. They just sent me out here to ask the question." This was not why Sipe had been sent out. but the message from Ralph Anderson, relayed to sight by Captain Horace Kinney, was to make sure everything stayed friendly, with no suspicions aroused. Claude examined the phone, then handed it back.
"Can't be positive. That was a while ago. But sure looks like it."
"Well, thank you. Thank you both." Sipe pocketed his phone and turned to go.
"That's it?" Claude asked. "You drove all the way out here to ask one question?"
"That's long and short of it. I guess someone really wants to know. Thank you for your time. I'll pass this along on my way back to Austin."
"That's a long drive, officer,"
Lovey said.
"Why don't you come in first and have a glass of sweet tea? It's only from a mix, but it ain't bad."
"Well, I can't come in and sit. I want to get home before dark if I can, but I'd take a taste out here if you don't mind."
"We don't mind a bit. Claude, go in and get this nice man a glass of tea."
"Small glass," Sipe said, holding his thumb and finger a smidge apart. "Two swallows and I'm down the road." Claude went in. Sipe leaned a shoulder against the side of the porch, looking up at Lovey Bolton, whose good-natured face was a river of wrinkles. "Your boy treats you pretty good, I guess."
"I'd be lost without him," Lovey declared. "He sends me allotment every other week, and comes down when he can. Wants to get me in an old folks' home in Austin, and I might go one of these days if he could afford it, which right now he can't. He's the best kind of son, Trooper Sipes. Hellraiser early, trustworthy later on."
"I heard that," Sipes said. "Say, he ever take you out to the Big Seven down the road there? They make one hell of a breakfast."
"I don't trust roadside cafes,"
she said, taking her cigarettes from the pocket of her house dress and clamping one between her dentures.
"Got ptomaine in one over Abilene way back in 74 and like to die. My boy takes over the cooking when he's here. He ain't no emerald, but he ain't bad. Knows his way around a skillet. Don't burn the bacon."
She dropped him a wink as she lit up, Sipe smiling and hoping there was a tight seal on her tank and she wasn't going to blow them both to hell. "I bet he made you breakfast this morning," Sipe said.
"You bet he did. Coffee, raisin toast, and scrambled eggs with plenty of butter, just the way I like 'em."
"Are you an early riser, ma'am? I only ask because with the oxygen and all..."
"Him and me both," she said. "Up with the sun."
Claude came back out with three glasses of iced tea on a tray, two tall ones and a shorty. Owen Sipe drank his in two gulps, smacked his lips, and said he had to be off. The Boltons watched him go, Lovey in her rocker, Claude sitting on the steps, frowning at the rooster tail of dust marking the trooper's progress back to the main road.
"See how much nicer the cops are when you ain't been doing nothing bad?"
Lovey asked. "Yeah," Claude said.
"Drove all the way out here just to ask about some belt buckle. Think of that."
"That wasn't why I came, Ma."
"No? Then why?"
"Not sure. That wasn't it." Claude put his glass down on the step and looked at his fingers. At can't. And must. The knot he had finally risen above. He stood up.
"I better get the rest of those clothes off the line. Then I want to go over to Jorge's and ask if I can help him out tomorrow. He's roofing."
"You're a good boy, Claude."
He saw tears standing in her eyes and was moved by them.
"You come here and give your ma a big old hug?"
"Yes, ma'am," Claude said, and did just that. 12. Ralph and Jeannie Anderson were getting ready to go to the meeting at Howie Gold's office when Ralph's cell phone rang. It was Horace Kinney. Ralph spoke to him while Jeannie put on her earrings and slipped into her shoes. "Thank you, Horace. I owe you one." He ended the call. Jeannie was looking at him expectantly. "Well?" "Horace sent a THP trooper out to the Bolton place in Marysville. He had a cover story, but what he was really there for..."
"I know what he was there for."
"Uh-huh. According to Mrs. Bolton, Claude cooked them breakfast around 6 o'clock this morning. If you saw Bolton downstairs at 4...
"I saw the clock when I got up to pee," Jeannie said. "It was 4:06.
MapQuest says the distance between Flint City and Marysville is 430 miles. He never could have made it from here to there in time to make breakfast at 6, honey.
The mother could have been lying. She said it without much conviction.
Sipe, the trooper Horace sent, said he didn't pick that up on his radar and thinks he would have.
So it's Terry all over again, she said. A man in two places at the same time. Because he was here, Ralph.
He was.
Before he could answer, the doorbell rang. Ralph shrugged on a sport coat to cover the Glock on his belt and went downstairs. District Attorney Bill Samuel stood on the front stoop, looking strangely unlike himself in jeans and a plain blue T-shirt.
Howard called me. Said there was going to be a meeting, an informal get-together about the Maitland business, is how he put it, at his office, and suggested I might like to come. I thought we could go together, if that's all right.
I guess so, Ralph said. But listen, Bill, who else have you told?
Chief Geller? Sheriff Doolin?
Nobody.
I'm no genius, but I didn't hit my head falling out of the dumb tree either.
Jeannie joined Ralph at the door, checking her purse.
Hello, Bill. I'm surprised to see you here.
Samuel's smile was without humor.
To tell you the truth, I'm surprised to be here. This case is like a zombie that won't stay dead.
What does your ex think about all this? Ralph asked, and when Jeannie gave him a frown, just tell me if I'm stepping out of line.
Oh, we've discussed it, Samuel said, except that's not quite right. She discussed, and I listened. She thinks I played a part in getting Maitland killed, and she's not entirely wrong.
He tried to smile and couldn't quite make it.
But how are we to know, Ralph? Tell me that. It was a slam dunk, wasn't it? Looking back? Knowing all we did? Can you honestly say you would have done anything different?
Yes, Ralph said. I wouldn't have arrested him in front of the whole fucking town. And I would have made sure he went into the courthouse by the back door. Come on, let's go. We're going to be late.
Macy's tells Gimbel's. July 25th. 1. As it turned out, Holly did not fly business class, although she could have if she had opted for the 10:15 Delta flight, which would have put her in Cap City at 12:30. Because she wanted some extra time in Ohio, however, she booked an arduous 3-stage trip on puddle jumpers that would probably bounce her all over the uneasy July air. Cramped and not particularly pleasant, but bearable. What she found less bearable was the knowledge that she wouldn't arrive in Flint City until 6 p.m., and that was if all her arrangements worked out perfectly. The meeting at Attorney Gold's office was scheduled for 7, and if there was one thing Holly hated above all others, it was being late for a scheduled appointment. Being late was the wrong way to get off on the right foot. She packed her few things, checked out of the hotel, and drove the 30 miles to Regis. She went first to the house where Heath Holmes had been staying with his mother on his vacation. It was closed up, the windows boarded across, likely because vandals had been using them for target practice. On the lawn, which badly needed mowing, was a sign that read, "For sale, contact First National Bank of Dayton." Holly looked at the house, knew that the local kids would soon be whispering that it was haunted, if they weren't already, and mused on the nature of tragedy. Like measles, mumps, or rubella, tragedy was contagious. Unlike those diseases, there was no vaccine. The death of Frank Peterson in Flint City had infected his unfortunate family and spread through the entire town. She doubted if that was quite the case in this suburban community where fewer people had long-term ties, but the Holmes family was certainly gone. Nothing left of them but this empty house. She debated taking a photo of the boarded-up house with the "for sale" sign in the foreground, a picture of sorrow and loss, if there ever was one, and decided not to. Some of the people she was going to meet might understand, might feel those things, but most of them probably would not. To them, it would just be a picture. She drove from the Holmes residence to the Peaceful Rest Cemetery on the outskirts of town. Here she found the family reunited, father, mother, and only son. There were no flowers, and the stone marking the resting place of Heath Holmes had been pushed over. She imagined the same thing might have happened to Terry Maitland's stone. Sorrow was catching, so was anger. His was a small marker, nothing on it but the name, the dates, and a bit of dried scum that might have been the residue of a thrown egg. With some effort, she set it up again. She had no illusions that it would stay that way, but a person did what a person could. "You didn't kill anyone, Mr. Holmes, did you? You were just in the wrong place at the wrong time." She found some posies on a nearby grave and borrowed a few to scatter on Heath's. Picked flowers were a poor remembrance. They died, but better than nothing. "You're stuck with it, though. Nobody here would ever believe the truth. I don't think the people I'm going to meet tonight will believe it either." She would try to convince them just the same. A person did what a person could, whether it was setting up gravestones or trying to convince 21st century men and women that there were monsters in the world, and their greatest advantage was the unwillingness of rational people to believe. Holly looked around and saw a vault on a nearby low hill. In this part of Ohio, all the hills were low. She walked to it, gazed at the name chiseled in the granite over the lintel. Graves. How appropriate. And walked down the three stone steps. She peered inside at the stone benches where one could sit and meditate on the graves of yesteryear here entombed. Had the outsider hidden here after his filthy work was done? She didn't believe so, because anyone, maybe even one of the vandals who had pushed over Heath Holmes' stone, might wander over for a peek inside. Also, the sun would shine into the meditation area for an hour or two in the afternoons, giving it a bit of fugitive warmth. If the outsider was what she believed he was, he would prefer darkness. Not always, no, but for certain periods of time. Certain crucial periods. She hadn't finished her research yet, but she was almost sure of that much. And something else. Murder might be its life's work, but sorrow was its food. Sorrow and anger. No, it hadn't taken its rest in this vault, but she believed it had been in this cemetery, perhaps even before the deaths of Mavis Holmes and her son. Holly thought she knew it might only be a fancy. She could smell its presence. Brady Hartsfield had had that same smell about him, the stink of the unnatural. Bill had known it. The nurses who had cared for Hartsfield had known it too, even though he was supposedly in a state of semi-catatonia. She walked slowly to the little parking lot outside the cemetery gates with her bag banging against her hip. Her Prius waited alone in the sizzling summer heat. She walked past it, then turned a slow 360, studying every aspect of the surrounding area. She was close to farm country. She could smell the fertilizer. But this was a transitional belt of industrial abandonment, ugly and barren. There would be no pictures of it in the Chamber of Commerce promotional brochures, assuming Regis had a Chamber of Commerce. There were no points of interest. There was nothing to attract the eye. It was repelled, instead, as if the very earth were saying, "Go away. There is nothing for you here. Goodbye. Don't come again." Well, There was the cemetery, but few people would visit peaceful rest once winter came, and the north wind would freeze those few away after the briefest of visits to make their manners to the dead. Yonder to the north were train tracks, but the rails were rusty, and there were weeds growing up between the cross ties. There was a long deserted train station, its windows boarded up like those of the Holmes house. Beyond it, on a spur, stood two lonely boxcars, their wheels buried in vines. They looked as if they had been there since the Vietnam era. Near the deserted station were long abandoned storage facilities and what she assumed were obsolete repair sheds. Beyond those, a broken factory stood hip deep in sunflowers and bushes. A swastika had been spray painted on crumbling pink bricks that had been red a long, long time ago. On one side of the highway that would take her back to town, a leaning billboard proclaimed, "Abortion stops a beating heart. Choose life." On the other side was a long, low building with a sign on its roof reading S-P-E-D-Y, Robo Car Wash. In its empty parking lot was another sign, one she'd seen once already today. "For sale. Contact First National Bank of Dayton." "I think you were here. Not in the vault, but close by, where you could smell tears when the wind was right, where you could hear the laughter of the men or boys who pushed over Heath Holmes' stone and then likely urinated on his grave." In spite of the day's heat, Holly felt cold. Given more time, she might have investigated those empty places. There was no danger. The outsider was long gone from Ohio. Very likely gone from Flint City, too. She snapped four pictures. The train station, the boxcars, the factory, the deserted car wash. She reviewed them and decided they would do. They'd have to. She had a plane to catch. Yes, and people to convince. If she could, that was. She felt very small and lonely just now. It was easy to imagine laughter and ridicule. Thinking of such things came naturally to her. But she would try. She had to. For the murdered children, yes. Frank Peterson and the Howard girls and all the ones who had come before them. But also for Terry Maitland and Heath Holmes. A person did what a person could. She had one more stop to make. Luckily, it was on her way. 2. An old man sitting on a bench in Trotwood Community Park was happy to give her directions to the place where the bodies of those poor gals had been found. It wasn't far, he said, and she would know it when she got there. She did. Holly pulled over, got out, and gazed at a ravine which mourners and thrill-seekers masquerading as mourners had attempted to turn into a shrine. There were glittery cards upon which words like sorrow and heaven predominated. There were balloons, some deflating, some fresh and new, even though Amber and Jolene Howard had been discovered here 3 months earlier. There was a statue of Mary, which some wag had decorated with a mustache. There was a teddy bear that made Holly shudder. Its plump brown body was covered with mold. She raised her iPad, took a picture. There was no whiff of that smell she had gotten, or imagined she'd gotten, at the cemetery, but she had no doubt the outsider would have visited this place at some point after the bodies of Amber and Jolene had been discovered sampling the grief of the pilgrims to this makeshift shrine, like a fine old burgundy. Also, the excitement of those, not many, but a few, there were always a few, who came to meditate on what it might be like to do such things as had been done to the Howard girls, and listen to their screams. Yes, you came, but not too soon, not until you could do so without attracting.